Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests. So please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children. And it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present and those emerging.
With Anne Fulton.
In business news, the chase for Christopher Skase's millions is unveiling some surprises. Here's the Business Review Weekly's Robert Gottliebson.
As the lawyers begin the complex task of trying to attract Christopher Skase back to Australia, some of the best accounting minds in the country are now focusing on the web of companies that Skase set up to surround his Quintex operation. At his bankruptcy hearing, Skase claimed that his assets had been reduced to no more than $6,000 and that his personal debts stood at a staggering $172 million. But Christopher has embraced a lifestyle in Spain, which indicates that he has access to a much larger pool of money.
When Bryce and Alec from the excellent Equity Mates podcast told me they had a true crime / finance crossover story they wanted to talk about, I did not expect it to bring back such happy memories for me. Equity Mates is an investing podcast aimed at millennials. But to my great delight, they wanted to talk about a story from the 1980s. It all happened before they were even born, but right in the middle of my formative teenage years and on our one and only family TV set. It's the story of one of Australia's infamous flamboyant 80s high flyers, the one and only Christopher Skase. It's fascinating to see the story through the eyes of a younger generation, but also through the eyes of people who, frankly, understand the intricacies of it better than I ever have. This week's Australian True Crime is a look back at a tumultuous era that in many ways, for better or for worse, shaped the country we live in today. Welcome to the Equity Mates.
I actually can't remember the pinpoint the time that I knew about it. It's just always been one of those like OG fraudulent finance guys that when you're in the world of finance and starting to think about and explore the world of investing and business and entrepreneurship and stuff, like the story would pop up.
I think Bryce has been coy. He's been planning his escape for years.
Yeah, right. Mallorca.
Yeah.
Yeah, full credit. It shows a nice little place.
I know, right? I mean, I don't think many Australians had heard of Mallorca until this, and like now I watch the British shows on the Lifestyle Channel and stuff, and you know, they're all looking for their holiday homes in Spain, and every now and then Mallorca pops up and I think, oh, okay, nice choice. Yeah. Okay,
yes.
No extradition treaty with Australia. Yeah. I get it. So, all right, let's go back to the 80s and this sort of boom of the flashy Australian billionaire. I mean, well, that's who I think of. When I think of Christopher Skase, I think of the whole gang, the Alan Bond, the John Friedrich, the whole, this crazy time, and I was a teenager at this time. So in my mind, it all melds together with like Expo 88 and Madonna and, this whole glorious time in my life, to be honest.
Packer?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
he was kicking around.
Murdoch was making moves.
Well,
like,
this is it. Some of them survived and thrived, like, of course, Murdoch, but some of them absolutely soared and just got too close to the sun, didn't they?
Yeah, well, a lot of them ended up in jail.
Yep, absolutely.
We're going to speak about Christopher Skase here, but
famously did not go to jail, but a lot of them bought into the media. Our TV stations were owned by these guys and they were in the media, and a lot of them were just very much admired at this time. They were suddenly, we had some guys getting around the place who were rich. They were real larrikins. I mean, Bondi won us the America's Cup, for goodness sake.
Yes.
And Hawke, our Prime Minister, said, bloody, have a public holiday. This is amazing. We love these guys. They're changing the face of Australia and they're changing the way we see ourselves in the world.
Mm.
So tell us, where did these guys come from? Where did this sudden boom in billionaires come from in Australia? How did it happen?
Yeah, I mean, the 1980s were the greed is good period of our history, and there was a lot of deregulation. We had Thatcher in the UK, we had Reagan in the US, and, you know, where those two countries lead, Australia often follows.
What does deregulation mean?
So a lot of formerly government organisations were privatised, so they were run by the private sector and a lot of these guys could buy into them, but also the rules around different industries, who could own what companies could do, how they could compete, a lot of it really eased up. And then in the financial sector, the ability to get money, there was a boom in junk bonds, which is like higher risk debt. So all of a sudden, there was a lot more money flying around and people and companies could get money where they couldn't get it before. So all of a sudden, there was this fuel of people could do a lot more than they could previously and they could get a lot more money than they could previously.
So they could get loans with less assets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Governments try to do it to stimulate activity, but it does sometimes come, as we're about to go through, with some cowboys that take advantage,
yes,
I would say.
Yes, yeah. And in the 1980s, it was a real ideological thing as well. Thatcher and Reagan they didn't like government and they didn't want government involved in many aspects of life, and we saw what happened.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, they hated welfare and they certainly had a financial perspective that was along the lines of, you know, if you work hard, you succeed, and anyone who's poor is poor because they're not trying hard enough, and no one should have to take care of anyone else, right? That's sort of the backbone of Reaganomics, right?
Mm.
We shouldn't have a welfare system. We shouldn't be paying taxes to take care of people. Everyone should get up and get a job and take care of themselves.
And when it comes to this story and the financial deregulation story, they had a view that the market was efficient and it allocated resources and the government should get out of the way and let private enterprise do its thing. And in the 1980s, private enterprise certainly did its thing. And by the end of the 1980s, a lot of private enterprises were no longer doing the thing because they were bankrupt.
Right. So if we look at one private enterprise in particular, the Quintex Group, that was Christopher Scase's company.
Yeah, and Quintex, weird name. And the reason that it's a funny name is because Christopher Scase and some of his partners literally bought Quintex off the shelf. It was a Tasmanian shelf company. Now, that's different to a shell company. A shelf company, a lot of lawyers and accountants will have pre-made companies that people can just come in and buy. And so this was one of them. It had nothing going for it, but they just bought this company and then they started doing business within it. And that's why it was called Quintex.
Okay. So you can just do whatever you want. It's just a legal company. It's kind of got nothing. And then you can just make it whatever you want it to be.
Yeah. It just saves you some time and some paperwork. And so Quintex becomes their takeover vehicle and they just start buying things with it. They started with a retail business, Hardy Brothers Jewelers, but then they expanded into a whole bunch of different businesses. They bought car dealerships, they bought real estate development companies, and they even bought some regional TV networks. And that was the sort of the start of it all.
It should be said, though, he didn't have a whole lot of experience in this, though. He was just an ex-stockbroker, right? And a journalist.
And a financial journalist.
And a financial journalist. Yeah. So.
And fun fact, his dad was an award-winning opera singer.
Oh, that is a fun fact.
Not relevant to this story at all. And really, I guess, from those early beginnings of Quintex, we move into the mid-1980s and it becomes a dominant force in the Australian business landscape. Scase's name gets put up there with, you know, the Alan Bonds of the world. And really, 1987 is the big year because they buy one of the three TV stations. They buy Channel 7 for $780 million.
What a steal.
How did that happen? Did he have some, or did they have some big wins along the way, like with the jewelers or the car yards or anything?
All of the above, I think, did okay. But how it happened was debt. And that's the story of the 1980s, and that's how all of these, I want to say entrepreneurs, but they weren't really entrepreneurs, these corporate raiders, whatever you want to call them, built such big empires so quickly. It was the availability of debt meant they could borrow more and acquire more things at a faster rate than we'd ever seen before and that we've ever seen since.
Why do you think the media is such a desirable asset? I mean, Alan Bond bought Channel 10, right?
Alan Bond bought Channel 9.
Yeah.
And then bought 9,
Terry Packer bought it back off him at a steal. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, and Rupert Murdoch has always been a media baron. And even today, as much as his media assets are, you know, worth less and less, he won't let go of them. He loves the media. Why did Scase and Bondi buy into the media?
I mean, we're both in media and you can, when you're in it, you understand that having audience comes with a lot of benefits, one of which, when you have national audience, it comes with a lot of power and the ability to influence what people are seeing, what people are thinking. It gives you the ability to engage in national level debate and put your spin on things. So when you buy one of the very few TV channels and or major newspapers, yeah, you have a lot of power and say. And I think outside of the revenue that you can generate from that, but these guys, you know, cynically, that's why they're buying.
I mean, we know Rupert Murdoch is very invested in politics, but I guess that's what I'm asking. Were Alan Bond and Christopher Scase equally invested in politics, or was it about sort of promoting their other businesses or?
Yeah, I think all of the above are, and it's also a prestige asset. Like you've really arrived in a different circle of society if you're a major, own a major masthead or a major TV network. Alan Bond was certainly involved in politics, but more WA politics and the corruption scandal over there. But that's a whole other episode of Australian true crime. Yeah. But, you know, it ended up with people, including the WA Premier, going to jail. So, but I think Christopher Scase, so Channel 7 was probably the big purchase. But it wasn't the only big thing that they became known for. He had a massive financial interest in the Brisbane Bears AFL club. And I think probably most notably, his legacy lives on today as really putting Port Douglas on the map as a tourist destination.
Mm.
He did too. He was a property developer.
Mm. Yeah, he owned a number of resorts, this big five-star resort in Port Douglas. He also owned a resort in Hawaii.
Five resorts or something.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah,
big money in resorts.
Yeah.
He built the Sheraton Mirage in Port Douglas. Never been there. I've actually never been to Port Douglas, but...
Oh, yeah, I've heard it's a great place.
I've heard it's a great place.
We should go and stay at... Because it still exists, I think, today, the hotel.
Yeah.
I honestly do go to Port Douglas a bit because I'm a Queenslander, and I think Queensland's more Queensland the further north you go. So I love Port Douglas. But and also the Sheraton, it's quite out of place. Port Douglas is still a very down-to-earth place. Even though there are millionaires and billionaires there, it's the kind of place where you could be sitting next to someone and not know if they're a billionaire or a broke. And people really pride themselves on that. And so it's still, yeah, as I say, it's still quite out of place, that resort there. But I remember when they opened it, was that when they, did they get Whitney Houston and Frank Sinatra there?
I think it was a pretty extravagant opening, but yeah.
It would be right in the wheelhouse of Christopher Skase to do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if another fun fact, if you have been or are going to go to Port Douglas, there's a row of oil palms apparently lining the entrance. Now, that was famously planted by Mr. Skase himself. So, well, I don't know if he literally planted them.
Maybe he paid for it to be.
But he had them put in. So every time you drive in, you'll see these palm trees and you'll probably always think of this story now.
Mm.
Yeah, no, he definitely had, because I can remember as plain as day for many reasons. One is I'm a big Whitney Houston fan. And I remember that he definitely did have Frank Sinatra and Whitney Houston open that resort, and poor Whitney did not sing very well. In fact, I don't think Frank did either, Sinatra. And so it was the tickets were really expensive and it was outdoors and there was a lot of hoo-ha about how shit the gig was.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, but Skase was, and because he also publicised how much he paid them to come. I think he paid them like $1 million each to come.
Wow.
Which at the time was, you know, Beyonce money now. And, it was a very big deal, of course. And let's not forget his beautiful wife, Pixie. Pixie Skase was very much part of the whole show, and she was a very flamboyant billionaire's wife. So they used to appear on Channel 7 a lot, on the variety shows and things of that nature. They really used it to their own advantage that way. You know, they weren't quiet like the Packers didn't used to pop up on Channel 9. They were sort of a bit above that, but not the Skases.
Profile building.
Yeah.
Well, this could have been the peak, the extravagance of the Sheraton Mirage and everything that had come before it, because I think it wasn't soon after this that it all started to fall in a big heap.
Yeah, it was quite a short reign, wasn't it?
Yes, very short. What, less than 10 years he had.
Well, he bought Channel 7 in 1987 and everything started to collapse in 1989. So not long at all. So the first visible crack was also his biggest move, which was he obviously had gone out of Australia with the resort in Hawaii. So this wasn't his first move out of Australia, but he tried to buy MGM Film Studios, the giant film studio in Los Angeles, which Amazon has recently bought for a stupid amount of money. Christopher Skase tried to buy it, but it was the late 80s and the go-go years of the 1980s had really slowed down. The 1987 crash I think everyone sort of realised there was a lot going on.
We need to chill out.
Mm. Yeah, we had a massive stock market crash in 1987, right?
So, yeah, and by 1989, interest rates were starting to rise as well. And so all of these companies that have so much debt and were fueling all their acquisitions and growth by debt all of a sudden had rising interest rates and couldn't afford that debt. And so things were getting really tough.
Mate, it was tough enough in my house and we only had a taxi. I can't imagine how tough it was in the Skase household. Yeah.
Now, look, don't feel too sorry for Christopher Skase, because there are still stories of him. I think there's one story of a party that they were throwing in Port Douglas and Pixie forgot her dress. So he sent the plane down to Sydney to pick up Pixie's dress and then fly it back to Port Douglas.
That's
so
unbelievable.
The sympathy only goes so far for some of these people. But the MGM deal was announced, and then the funding, the banks that were going to fund it over in the States pulled out because of the amount of debt Quintex already had. And so for everyone, that was a bit of a warning sign that things aren't great. But it was their biggest acquisition to date, so that was probably forgivable. But then one of their American subsidiaries went bankrupt. So a company that Quintex owned over in America couldn't pay its debts and went bankrupt, which was a bit of a warning as well. And then the thing that really pushed Quintex over the edge, remember, a lot of its assets were tourism resorts in places like Hawaii and Port Douglas. In 1989, Australia saw one of its biggest ever industrial actions, one of its biggest ever strikes. The 1989 Australian pilot strike crippled the tourism industry for months, and that crippled the amount of traffic going to his resorts.
Which crippled the resort's revenue.
Well, yes, yes.
So 1989 was a year of rising interest rates, reduced revenues on his business. He was in a lot of financial trouble, really.
And Scacey then has a falling out with his board. He asked the board to approve a payment to a company that he owned, which is...
No-no.
A no-no to begin with. The board refused, but it came out that he had already made that payment without their approval. So, yeah, not good. So one of the directors reported Christopher Scase to the Australian Securities Commission, so the Australian government regulators. The story goes, apparently Christopher Scase then turned around and asked the board to give him a pay rise.
Well, how else is he supposed to pay back the money he's already loaned himself?
I know. So I think even at this point he was never without confidence.
Yes.
But that really, between the company going bankrupt in America and these complaints from the board to the Australian Securities Commission, the Australian Securities Commission then puts their focus on Quintex and starts asking for documents to prove that they're financially healthy.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So what happened was they couldn't provide any documents, as Ren said. Quintex then had $700 million in debt. Scase himself personally had $80 million in debt. So they're all debted up to their eyeballs, really struggling to pay it off. As a result, Quintex stock was listed on the stock exchange. It was suspended from trading, I guess, while the Australian Securities Commission looked into things and said, there's a lot going on here. We need to figure it out. Subsequently, Quintex files for bankruptcy in 1989, and Scase, not too soon after, under a lot of financial pressure, can't pay his debts back, files for bankruptcy in 1991. So from 1987, he bought Channel 7, $780 million, talk of the town. 1991, 4 years later or thereabouts, 5 years later, he's bankrupt. Done.
He is an individual or Quintex?
Both. So the Quintex is bankrupt in 89, and personally he's filed for bankruptcy in 1991. And at this point, when this happens to businesses, this is when liquidators move in to try and recover as many assets as they can from the business to pay back people who have essentially invested in the business or are owed money, and that's where it can really start to get in trouble.
Mm.
Yeah.
And is that when they start to try and find someone responsible?
Yeah. So not yet. At this point, Scacy's okay. So like from a personal point of view, you know, companies go bankrupt, especially in the late 80s and early 90s. There was no idea of impropriety yet. Okay.
It's tough financial times.
Yeah.
And,
you know, like I'm trying to think of a company that, you know, Dick Smith Electronics went bankrupt a few years ago. Yeah. Things happen. So the resorts that he owned get sold to Japanese investors. Channel 7 gets sold and, you know, these liquidators are selling these assets and trying to get the money back to pay back the debts. Unfortunately, they don't get nearly enough money to pay back the debts. The State Bank of Victoria was one of the largest lenders to Quintex. It collapses largely because it had lent so much money to Quintex, it couldn't recover any money. And then it itself, this bank, State Bank of Victoria, goes bankrupt. And that's sort of the end of the corporate bankruptcy story. And
people sitting here are like, come on, this is a crime podcast. What's going on? All you've told us is the story of a...
It's like for a lot of corporate bankruptcy stories, that's the end of the story. Like, that's it. They go bankruptcy. They try and pay back their debts. They do what they can. See you later. But that's not the end of the story here.
Well, it turns out that Scace had been secretly moving company money into foreign bank accounts. Dun-dun.
Yes.
So he'd secretly done some transfers to estimated to be $170 million from when Quintex filed bankruptcy in 1989 and Scace files bankruptcy in 1991. So between that period, he was shuffling money from Quintex into his, I guess, private bank account, so somewhere overseas, and it emerges that he'd approved hefty management fees to be paid from Quintex to him personally. So
how much again? Tell me how much again?
$170 million. That we're aware of.
I mean, it's like, you know what? Do you need $170 million, Chris? It's like, I see what you're doing. I see what you've done there. You've gone, this is about to shit itself. Yeah. And let's just feather our nest. Let's pick a spot, you know, let's skim a bit off the top. $170 million?
I know. Well, yeah. he did file for bankruptcy to the tune of $80 million himself in debt, so probably wanted to have the ability to pay that off at some point in time. But anyway.
I reckon at this point he knew what like, he was gonna
do. Yeah. Let's go. So approving management fees, obviously what he's done is illegal under Australian law. And so what happened was this is where the Australian police move in and actually make an arrest. So he was charged with improperly using his position to obtain management fees, briefly arrested and spent a night in jail.
A night.
But you would think there would be more than that. He was subsequently released and allowed to regain his passport. However, he was told to stay in the area. Does he stay in the area? No. Next morning, he's on a flight to Spain. So he fled the country on a flight to Spain, and then the chase was on. He was discovered in 1991 by the Sydney Morning Herald in Mallorca.
Yes.
Not the cops. Not another government.
No.
The Sydney Morning Herald. He claimed he was penniless but living in a $2 million mansion on the island, living large.
I remember it well. I remember the blurry photographs very well. Photographs taken sort of literally behind palm leaves of Scacy sitting on stunning furniture, like outdoor furniture around a pool, living so beautifully. The outrage of the nation. I'll never get over it. And did he come out immediately and say, oh, I'm sick though?
Yeah, so he very quickly started claiming he was sick. In 1994, the Australian government felt like they had enough evidence to get him, they brought 60 criminal charges against him, and they spent multiple years trying to extradite him. So Spain and Australia do have an extradition treaty, and this is where the claims of being sick really started to escalate and, I guess, be quite strategic for him, because...
It's very hard to claim illness when you've got that deep a tan.
Yes, yes.
Very hard when you look that well.
Tan, muscles.
You know, yeah. Oh, so tan. Yeah, it just looks so well rested.
And photos of him walking on the beach, you know, like,
in the white pants and in the linen. And to say, yeah, but I'm that sick, guys. Honestly, I could not get on a plane. I just couldn't.
Well, when he was rocking up to court, he was rocking up in a wheelchair, claiming he had emphysema and a whole bunch of other health issues. And he was arrested. Now, here's the thing. So there's an extradition treaty with Australia and Spain. Spanish authorities detain him, and he was actually held for 11 months in Mallorca in a jail, but mainly in the hospital jail, like claiming he was sick. So 11 months, he was held. He claimed he was too sick to travel. I think the first Spanish court upheld the extradition, but then on appeal, the Spanish courts decided he was too sick to travel.
Was that when the oxygen tank came out somewhere during that period of time?
Yeah, yeah. Oxygen tank, wheelchair, the whole nine yards. He played the Spanish courts for fools. And now, how's this for an Australian public that were infuriated by Christopher Skase? As he walks out of the hospital after being released and the extradition case not going ahead, he compared his 11 months in a Mallorca hospital to the suffering of South Africa's Nobel Peace Prize winner, President Nelson Mandela, and to the UK peace envoy, Terry Waite, who was a hostage in the Middle East.
The bravado.
The shamelessness.
And then... A few days later, there were photos of him walking on Spanish beaches in Mallorca again.
Well, that was his long walk to freedom.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. So then the decade-long chase continued, the chase for Skase, including Andrew Denton trying to raise money for a bounty hunter. He managed to raise $250,000 to, well, the group managed to raise $250,000, but they took it down on legal advice.
So Andrew Denton did.
Yeah, unfortunately, the bounty hunter didn't come to fruition. That would have been a crazy end to the story.
Imagine.
Probably would have put this actually in true crime. But then in May 1998, the Aussie government cancelled Skase's passport, at which point he was ordered to leave Mallorca by the 23rd of July, but he lodged an appeal. The extradition process was still tied up in the courts, and then following, he became a citizen of the Dominican Republic.
Or no, Dominica. I think Dominica. a small Caribbean nation.
Tiny Caribbean nation.
Yeah. Now, the irony of that is I think Australia and Dominica also have an extradition treaty, but there was a lot of commentary at the time that because he wasn't a citizen, I don't really know why, but a lot of commentary at the time saying that the chase for Skase was over, and that there was nothing more that could be done to bring him back to Australia. And whether or not that was true, in the end, it didn't really matter, because in August 2001, he actually was sick and he died of stomach cancer.
In Mallorca.
In Mallorca.
Yeah.
In his 50s, so not super old.
Yeah, 52.
No. Well, it'd be the stress of everything. I mean, seriously, it is, you know, it can't have been relaxing.
No way.
No matter where you live and how much sun you're getting and how many millions you've taken with you and, you know, how nice your villa, it is stressful. All of this, being chased and having all the legal stuff.
I imagine almost being stuck on that island, because if he had gone to another country in Europe, like that potentially would have been detained, extradition proceedings, yeah. The great irony of this all is Australia is pretty soft on white-collar crimes.
Yes.
And at this stage, you know, when he was first detained in Australia before he fled, it was for the illegal management fees. It wasn't for, you know, embezzling all this money from his company into his offshore accounts.
Got away with the $170 million.
Australia is incredibly light on these crimes, and estimates are he probably would have got months in jail, if anything. But instead he fled and he let it chase him for the rest of his life. And he was detained for 11 months. So
yeah, so he probably did more time, or at least, you know, he did time. I think, what do you think? Ego? Hubris?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Classic example of being in too deep and then not being able to get out as well. Yeah.
And so his wife, Pixie was never charged with anything. Anyone around him?
No. Here's the story of Pixie. So Pixie's still alive and she may be listening to this because she's back in Australia. She's living in Melbourne.
I felt for Pixie, and I might be silly, but I just got the impression that Pixie was not involved in Christopher's sort of financial dealings. I got the impression that Pixie was your classic sort of, I don't know how to put it, I'm not going to say trophy wife, but I had the impression that Pixie had other duties within the relationship, that she was an entertainer, if you will.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, once you flee to Mallorca, you know, I think you're all in on it at that point. Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. But I do think, you know, she suffered as well, and she nursed Christopher to his death, and all of that's horrible. And
I think that the money has never been recovered.
I was just thinking probably still in account somewhere.
Well, thank you. That is amazing. Having, you know, I lived through it. You didn't. But I didn't hold on to any of those details at the time because I was a kid, and all I knew was that everyone was furious. And there was a lot of swearing around it all, and a lot of shouting. Even on the TV, there was a lot of people shouting at Christopher whenever he popped up. I remember him being on television, though. I remember watching a show that was on Saturday mornings. It was like kind of like Saturday morning hits, but there was comedians on it and stuff, and he'd be on it. He'd be on the couch in his suit, you know, and they'd go, oh, look, the boss is here. And there'd be Christopher like the Grim Reaper down the end of the couch. Because he wasn't a jovial chap, but he wanted to be on the TV a lot. I remember that. And then when things went pear-shaped, people, whenever he popped up, people shouting at him, Mr. Skase, have you got anything to say? And he'd be stumm. And then next minute they're in Mallorca shouting at him over his hedges. And then he's in his wheelchair. So I could never quite understand all the detail of what happened. So you filled in a lot of blanks for me. Thank you so much.
Now, I think the other side of the Channel 7 story is it's great when you can be the boss and appear on it, but Channel 7, I think, was the most angry at Christopher Skase, and I think they fueled a lot of the anger and the 10-year chase for Skase. I think there was a lot of long memories and hard feelings at that network, and they took
it. Yes, Jennifer Kite's face is coming to mind. You're right. A very grumpy Jennifer Kite.
Yeah. So if you ever are in a position to own a media company, do not piss them off.
You're so right. Whew, I'm going to remember that. Thank you to our guests today, Bryce and Alec from Equity Mates Investing Podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts.
If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.